As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was good.
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today I think we're bringing kind of a sequel episode, but a sequel to multiple prequels. What streams are coming together on this one?
All right. Well, for starters, we're following up on a previous episode we did about Quetzalcoatl. This was an episode that dealt with this deity of pre-Columbian Mesoamerican traditions, this plumed serpent being. And in that episode, we discussed the myths surrounding it, the tradition surrounding it, as well as its ties into paleontology with the prehistoric Quetzalcoatlus, which is named for this deity.
Right. You know, just recently in town at the Fernbank Science Museum, they had an exhibit on pterosaurs. Of course, Quetzalcoatlus is the greatest. Yeah. Well, I think there may actually have been – there was some dispute about this while I was there. There may be indications of a larger one. But yeah, the Quetzalcoatlus has long at least been understood to be the largest known of the pterosaurs.
Yeah, so big that there have at times been competing theories as to whether it actually flew or if it just shambled around like this big walking winged creature and just scavenged from the seaside.
But they had a full model and full cast of this creature there up in the air where you could – compare your own puny, delicious body to this powerful predator that would have sorry to get sidetracked. The thing about those pterosaurs that's most terrifying is not what they look like when they're in flying posture, but how they walk. This is a thing that we've come to understand more over time because there used to be this debate about what exactly their locomotion would look like when they weren't in flight. Would they just crawl on vertical surfaces or something? But now we have a pretty good idea of how pterosaurs generally walked around on flat ground, and it just looks awful. It just looks like, this weird, jumbly, membranous robot. It's amazing. You should look it up.
So that was a case where we had a later fossil find, and then they named the species after this Mesoamerican serpent god. But we didn't get into any actual fossil connections beyond that. In other episodes, though, we have discussed this idea of geomythology. We've devoted whole episodes to generally looking at some sort of mythological monster and saying, you know, asking the obvious question, a question that people have been asking for quite a while, were these ideas of, be it dragons or cyclopses, whatever, but were they inspired by fossils that were discovered by ancient peoples?
Yeah. Was it pure imagination, or was it based on something they'd seen? And if it was based on something they'd seen, was it, you know, an exaggerated account of a live animal, or maybe a misinterpretation of bones or fossils that had been made from the bones of long dead creatures? And it's not hard at all to see how, say, a dragon might be inspired by the skull of a dinosaur, you know, especially like maybe a large theropod dinosaur. Imagine coming across that when you didn't know there was such a thing as dinosaurs. And there are many ways that the geological features of fossils can make them seem especially mystical and like they're some kind of monster with supernatural properties. A great example of this is given this was in our last discussion where we talked about the work of Adrienne Mayer, who's going to come up again in today's episode, and we'll brief you a bit more on who she is in a moment. But we talked about her book, The First Fossil Hunters, Paleontology in Greek and Roman Times. And one of the examples she talks about in that book that I remember standing out in my head was this interesting example that in some regions, calcite and selenite crystals form inside fossilized bones, which could have been connected to tales of gemstones within dragons' heads.
Ooh. So let's talk about Adrienne Mayer. So born in 1946, still active in the world today, Stanford University historian of ancient science and a classical folklorist who specializes in geomythology.
Yeah.
And she's written several books of interest, including a 2018 book on gods and robots in mythology.
Yeah, all about Talos.
Yeah.
Not all about Talos, but Talos features,
you know, he's
big
in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you also probably remember us discussing her 2000 book, The First Fossil Hunters, Paleontology in Greek and Roman Times, which deals with these very questions.
Yeah.
In the ancient Greeks, in depicting and imagining these various creatures, were they commenting on fossil finds?
Yeah. And in that episode, we talked about a bunch of examples put forth by Mayer where discovery of fossils by ancient peoples could have given rise to legends of mythical beasts. We just talked about the dragon example, but a few others, like the idea that legends of the fearsome griffin, you know, the jealous gold hoarding creature with a lion's body and the, you know, the wings, that creature of the Gobi Desert could have been inspired by the discovery of Protoceratops fossils, though we also discussed arguments against this connection. Another one that was very popular was the idea that tales of the Cyclops could have been inspired by elephant skulls, which of course have this large single hollow or socket in the center that could easily be mistaken for a giant single eye socket in the middle of the face, though it actually is the nasal cavity that connects to the trunk.
But she also turned her attention to the world of the plumed serpent in her 2005 book, Fossil Legends of the First Americans.
Yeah.
So in this, she points out that pre-Columbian Aztec codices and Inca traditions describe the remains or seem, in her estimation, to describe the remains of mammoths and other creatures from the past, including giant birds.
Hmm.
And of course, this is where we come back to Quetzalcoatl, because Quetzalcoatl, again, is generally depicted as this great serpent with feathers, this reptilian being that is also bird-like. And it's really kind of surprising looking back on it that we didn't actually explore this avenue, because it makes so much sense, right? Like you're talking about this amorphous idea, and generally all ideas in mythology over the landscape of time are amorphous. They shift this way and that. But essentially, this sounds like it could line up rather well with pterosaur remains or even the remains of non-flying dinosaurs, you know, any kind of a sauropod. You could latch onto any of these, any evidence of some sort of great creature. And lo and behold, here is the evidence of Quetzalcoatl.
Yes, though the link between fossils and the possible inspiration of a plumed serpent being like Quetzalcoatl is not the only, say, Mesoamerican or South American example where we have a pretty good idea that bones of large creatures could have inspired belief in supernatural beings. A big example that comes in with Mesoamerican and South American mythology is the belief in giants.
Yes, and there's an interesting history there, and one that Mayer spends a lot of time with. So she points out that after Cortez arrived in the New World, the Tlaxcalteca people aligned with him against their enemies, the Aztecs. Mm-hmm. And they brought the conquistador gigantic bones, and they told him the story of how their ancestors had found these lands filled with these evil giants, and that they subsequently vanquished most of them, and the survivors were eventually just too few to continue and died out. And look, here are the bones that are proof of this story.
Yeah, I actually wanted to read from a firsthand account of what happened at this event. This is a firsthand account by Bernal Diaz de Castillo, one of the Spanish conquistadors who was working under Cortes. Now, keep in mind, anything we read here is just Castillo's version of the story written many years after the fact, and it's very possible he's not remembering everything accurately or not understanding or reporting correctly, but this firsthand account is what we have here. So he's speaking to some of the Tlaxcalteca people, and he's asking them, quote, how it was that they came to inhabit that land, and from what direction had they come, and how was it that they differed so much from and were so hostile to the Mexicans, as he's referring to the Aztecs, seeing that their countries were so close to one another. Quote, they said that their ancestors had told them that in times past there had lived among them men and women of giant size with huge bones, and because they were very bad people of evil manners, that they had fought with them and killed them, and those of them who had remained died off. So that we could see how huge and tall these people had been, they brought us a leg bone of one of them, which was very thick and the height of a man of ordinary stature, and that was the bone from the hip to the knee. I measured myself against it, and it was as tall as I am, although I am of fair size. I wonder if he's getting a little defensive there. I'm not that short. They brought other bones, they brought other pieces of bones like the first, but they were already eaten away and destroyed by the soil. We were all amazed at seeing those bones and felt sure that there must have been giants in this country, and our Captain Cortez said to us that it would be well to send that great bone to Castile so that His Majesty might see it. So we sent it with the first of our agents who went there. So I'd love to know what happened with that bone, but apparently that's a sad mystery that doesn't turn out well.
Yeah, Mayer writes that she tried to track it down, uh-huh, and couldn't quite find it. But she points out that this myth and this account of the myth, you know, it does reveal, you know, an understanding of several things. It reveals an understanding of extinction, for example,
right,
that a sufficiently reduced population is doomed.
Yeah,
it's just not going to bounce back.
So they didn't have to kill all of the giants. If they just reduced the population enough, the giants died out naturally.
Yeah. And she also points out, yeah, that those bones presented by the Tlaxcalteca were sent back to Spain, apparently, though there seems no surviving record of them after that. However, based on later fossils sent back to Spain and those displayed in Cortez's palace there in Mexico, we can judge that these were probably mammoth bones. Like, it seems it's not even it's a very safe guess.
I'm interested by this phenomenon of people seeing bones of large extinct megafauna and not just not knowing what they were, but concluding that they're some form of human, you know? And
yeah,
and obviously this is not just the conclusion reached by the Tlaxcalteca people. This is like a widespread – I mean, the Spanish seem to think the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, part of it is, you know, by virtue of our modern understanding of fossils and the ascent of man and knowing exactly what sort of humanoid and primate creatures lived that we know lived in prehistoric times.
Mm-hmm.
But and then on the other side, it's like we all have stories of giants. The Europeans brought with them, the Spanish brought with them knowledge of stories of giants.
No, the Spanish, like, they totally believed in giants.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy that all the things that are not lining up with Cortez here. Like, like, this is a doomed scenario, and we should really remind everyone that Cortez is a destroyer.
Oh, yeah.
Here in this encounter. But this is like one thing that they instantly both have in common is, mm-hmm, the belief in giants. So Mayer writes that that Father Jose de Acosta, who lived 1539 through 1600, traveled to Mexico and recorded native oral histories. And when he spoke to the Tlaxcalteca, they described the giants of old as beings that dwelt in caves and used great clubs and wooden swords. They, quote, pulled down trees as if they had been stalks of lettuces. And Mayer argues that this brings to mind the behavior of elephants and that the giants, again, might be essentially ancestral memories of the Colombian mammoths that definitely lived in the area, that we definitely have the fossil evidence of, that we see evidence of in the fossils displayed in Cortez Palace, that it's kind of through the telephone game of oral tradition and via the remaining fossil evidence of their bones, like this is the giant mythology that remains.
Right. So we know that these giant extinct mammals did stretch in the range as far south as like Central America, right?
Yeah. As far south as Costa Rica, I think I was reading, and up into the northern United States.
Though then again, I do think, I mean, I wonder about that. I mean, that is a long time for a legend like that to persist, even in altered form. Mm-hmm. The Colombian mammoth, which was the species that would have spread that far south, right? The woolly mammoth was a further north species. So the Colombian mammoth, this huge being, it went extinct probably like 10 to 11,000 years ago, we think. Certainly not impossible for, you know, elements of myth to exist across that time span, but I wouldn't let too much hinge on that inference because that's a long time.
A lot can happen, certainly from the human standpoint in that amount of time.
Yeah.
It's also worth pointing out that it wasn't just the Tlaxcalteca. The Inca also had tales of ancestral victories over giants. In this case, though, the giants were destroyed by fire from heaven.
Oh, yeah. So these myths were recorded in one of the places they were recorded was in a source in the 16th century. One of these was by Cieza de León in the Chronicle of Peru, published in 1553. So the people telling this story were people living in, I think it was Peru at the time, modern Ecuador, who told stories about how their ancestors in ancient times had been invaded by these people from the sea who were evil and destructive giants who landed at a point called Point Santa Elena in what's now Ecuador. And I want to read from Cieza de León's record of the stories that were told to him by the native peoples. He says, quote, "They arrived on the coast in boats made of reeds as big as large ships, a party of men of such size that from the knee downwards their height was as great as the entire height of an ordinary man, though he might be of good stature." So this, yet again, it's like part of the leg is as tall as a guy, even though he's pretty tall.
Right. They're making it clear.
Yeah. "Their limbs were all in proportion to the deformed size of their bodies, and it was a monstrous thing to see their heads, with hair reaching to the shoulders. Their eyes were as large as small plates. They had no beards and were dressed in the skins of animals, others only in the dress which nature gave them, and they had no women with them." And then so Cieza de León goes on to tell more about the story of the conflict between the people and these giants. Cieza de León does not strike me as a great narrator. He kind of disparages the people who are telling him the story. He refers to their vulgarity and says that they're prone to exaggeration. So I think he's got a patronizing attitude, it seems like here. But he also embellishes their account by adding Christian theological material to it. So later on, he says, quote, "All the natives declare that God, our Lord, brought upon them a punishment in proportion to the enormity of their offense." And he's talking about the giants here. "A fearful and terrible fire came down from heaven with a great noise, out of the midst of which there issued a shining angel with a glittering sword, with which at one blow they were all killed, and the fire consumed them. There only remained a few bones and skulls, which God allowed to remain without being consumed by the fire as a memorial of this punishment." So that's interesting. There's this idea that some bones are left for us to see. And so what about these bones? Well, Adrian Mayer writes about this in her account. She says that in 1543, there was a deputy governor of Trujillo named Juan de Olmos who decided to investigate these stories about the extinct giants and their bones by conducting a paleontological excavation. So that's pretty interesting, right? We got the 16th century here and they're trying to excavate the bones of extinct beings.
Yeah, essentially engaging in paleontology, which is one of Mayer's frequent points, is that when you're engaging with these fossils and you're trying to figure out what they were and how to fit into history, even though you're dealing with, say, you know, a version of history that is influenced by mythology and perhaps even the mythology of some, you know, conquerors who have just arrived, then you're still engaged in the exercise of trying to understand fossils.
Yeah. And that's what Juan de Olmos was apparently doing. So Mayer writes that Olmos and his workers, they went and they dug up pits in this valley that they'd been directed to by the native peoples, where the giants had been reportedly destroyed or put down by this angel from heaven, or where they'd been consumed by the fire or put down by this being from the sky. And then they apparently found some things. They found skulls that seemed to look sort of human. And remember, again, the comparison between like the idea of the cyclops and the giant elephant skulls.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it is unlike so many, large herbivore skulls, the elephant skull does not look, it's not a long skull. It is not like the skull of a deer or even like a hippo or something. It does seem to have like the vertical alignment of a primate skull.
Mm-hmm. Though then again, these bones were found to not be exactly human in proportion. And this was explained away by the fact that, well, in the story, these giants, they've got all these deformities, that's it's almost like an indication of their monstrousness, which is sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? We're looking for human-shaped things that aren't correctly human-shaped because they were monsters. Therefore, when the things aren't correctly human-shaped, almost can conclude, yeah, okay, we found the bones of giants here. And apparently they did. So, they dug up these bones. They said, yep, looks like there were giants.
And Mayer points to other sources as well on this, such as leading Mexican archaeologist Dr. Leonardo Lopez Lujan, who backs up the notion that Mesoamerican myths of giants and ogres originated in at least the discovery of fossil remains, without getting into the sort of oral history thing. But I should probably add that, like, there's the oral history of the creatures, but then there's just the oral history of finding the fossils.
Right.
And I think that's probably more what we're talking about here. Somebody found these bones once, and maybe they kept the bones, maybe they didn't, but there is the story of the encounter and then the subsequent interpretation of what the bones mean.
Okay, I think maybe we should take a quick break. We'll be right back with more.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun, and I can't wait for you to hear it.
Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elia Kani, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So, you know, I want to drive home that, you know, we're talking about Quetzalcoatl and some of these other traditions. You know, there's a lot we don't know about these cultures. Again, Cortez and those who came after him, they were a destroying force. Mm-hmm. They were conquerors. They brought with them death and disease, and often cases like a willingness, an intent to destroy the culture of the people that they subjugated.
Yeah, so, and did that in many cases through literally destroying written records.
Right. So, you know, there luckily some things survived, but so much was destroyed. We're talking about the Mesoamerican world initially, like 700 years ago, and yet. As is often pointed out, in case was pointed out by University of New Mexico's Professor David M. Johnson, that we know more about Athens, Greece, of 2,000 years ago, or we know more about Hebraic traditions of 3,000 years ago than we know about Mesoamerica 700 years ago.
Because mainly of the destruction of the conquistadors.
Yeah, the destruction that they wrought on the cultures, the destruction of codices that the Aztecs and the Maya kept. And on top of this, the hieroglyphic style books of the Aztecs, you know, that were there to aid in the memorization of oral literature. So, you know, you're destroying it on both ends. If you're destroying the culture that retains the oral tradition, but then you're also destroying the books that enabled it to begin with. You know, so it's often a taxing exercise to try and reassemble, you know, what some of these stories and traditions actually were. But Quetzalcoatl, as we discussed in our previous episode, they're basically like two major different like sagas of it or him. They're sort of the more primal myths and then the more humanoid myths.
Yeah, that was the distinction I remembered, sort of like the celestial Quetzalcoatl, like the creator being, and then there's like the human version or the human embodiment.
Right. And ultimately, I think that's something that ended up lining up a lot with sort of Christian traditions, the idea of there being sort of a part one that's very cosmic and a little harder to grasp, and then a second part that's a little more human in its telling.
Yeah.
But in both of these—
More like a hero legend.
Yeah, exactly. In both of these cases, though, it's really important to drive home that Quetzalcoatl was not like a bloodthirsty god. I think sometimes there is this tendency to— Someone says Aztec god, then you're going to instantly think about blood sacrifices or something like that.
Because of Q, the winged serpent in the movie, maybe.
Right, yeah, you're going to think of that. But Quetzalcoatl was, by all the accounts we were looking at, you know, this was a benign, benevolent even entity. This was a divine being that represented peace and not bloody warfare or anything of the sort. So I just want to drive that home before we continue here. And you're probably wondering, again, okay, you're talking about giants, you're talking about elephants, but what about Quetzalcoatl? What does Mayer write about the winged serpent? And she does mention him. She writes that in the Florentine Codex, which is a 16th century ethnographic research study in Mesoamerica conducted by a Spanish friar, that the human Quetzalcoatl was said to stop to rest with his followers on a journey at a place that was considered holy because, quote, the marks which Quetzalcoatl left upon the stone with his hands when he rested there, when he sat down, and he supported himself on the rock by his hands, they sank deeply, as if in mud did the palms of his hands seek down. Likewise, his buttocks, as they touched the rock, sank deeply.
Wow. And the holy buttock marks.
Yeah, of the winged serpent. And the place was known as Timocpalco, the impression of the hands. So we ultimately have no current knowledge or evidence of this place, no further descriptions or illustrations even in this this codex. But Mayer suspects they might have been, quote, a genuine track site, a track site being where we have the fossilized tracks of creatures, a genuine track site of some extinct creature, or else there were carvings that resembled fossilized prints, perhaps made to illustrate or commemorate an episode in the Quetzalcoatl epic. And I think the implication is in that case, you know, it could be something, if it was artificial, if it was man-made, it could have been inspired by actual fossilized tracks that had been discovered. Or she doesn't mention this, but I mean, I could imagine it could be a combination of the two, like the actual fossils that were then embellished by humans that are interpreting it as being part of a divine story.
Mm-hmm.
She also points out that in terms of extinction, the Aztecs believed that there were four previous ages that were destroyed by cataclysm,
mm-hmm.
and that survivors of these ages, monsters and giants, were sometimes encountered, you know, in subsequent ages. And Quetzalcoatl is said to have been created, said to have created the bones of fifth age humans by mixing blood with the ground bones of our fourth age ancestors.
Mm.
So, you know, there's already an emphasis on bones here. And Mayer thinks it's suggestive of bone grinding medicinal practices seen elsewhere among Native American peoples. But she also stresses that she found nothing in the Spanish accounts of Mesoamerican peoples regarding you know, bone grinding practices.
Mm-hmm.
However, she does point to a 20th century practice in the village of Charcas on the northern border of the old Aztec Empire. Famed for its mines, the villagers collected large fossil bones known as the I apologize for my Spanish here. Huesos de Espanto, the bones of fear. These would have been the bones of the old giant and the old giants that are now on the earth. And the ground powder was used in a potion to calm anxiety and fear.
Wow.
And she points out that this actually lines up with the use of ground dragon bones in Chinese traditional medicine and in the treatment of fossils by European apothecaries. Who would maybe, of course, I think we've discussed on Stuff to Blow Your Mind before about the use of mummified remains by apothecaries, but also fossil bones as well.
Yeah, mummy paste. Wait a minute. In the Chinese traditional medicine, what are the ground dragon bones? What bones end up becoming supposedly dragon bones?
Ooh, I'm not sure on that, actually. But it does bring to mind that we're perhaps talking about fossils here.
Yeah.
That we'll have to do a part three where we talk about the use of fossils in Chinese traditional medicine and in Chinese folklore. I'm offhand, I don't know for sure if Mayer has written about Chinese traditions exclusively in any book, or perhaps that's an upcoming book. All right. Well, let's take one more break. When we come back, we will continue to discuss geomythology and Quetzalcoatl.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question. Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, then look no further than the Marketing School podcast hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast in the United States and number 15 on business in the United States. And it has amazing guests such as Alex Hormozi, Layla Hormozi, Cody Sanchez. We pull in these amazing interviews with other people that are not only great marketers, but actual operators. And the icing on the cake is Neil and myself were also operators as well. So we share learnings from the trenches. We share secrets that we otherwise wouldn't be sharing with other people. And we also share other advantages that will help you get ahead of your competition. So all you have to do is listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So last time we talked about Quetzalcoatl, we obviously made the connection to pterosaur species because of the giant pterosaur Quetzalcoatlus, which gets its name from this magnificent Mesoamerican god. So I wonder, could there actually be any connection between pterosaur fossils and the belief in a giant plumed serpent god? On one hand, I would tend to assume, I don't know about that, because pterosaurs are not really, they're not really serpentine, are they?
That's true. And then, of course, another, and this is a key thing that we're always arguing, is that fossils are not necessary to dream up these creatures.
Like, of course.
As we discussed in the Quetzalcoatl episode previously, like the god embodies the snake and the bird. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's already embodying natural creatures that inspire various ideas about the world, the cosmos, and our role in it, and our relationship with nature.
Yeah,
it's already this hybrid being, and therefore this special kind of metaphor in human understanding.
Yeah, and that's something to keep in mind with all of these cases. Where, you know, geomythology is full of sort of interesting inferential hypotheses. It's hard. It's in most cases going to be really hard to make a solid case that yes, a mythical beast or a legend or something from an ancient religion is definitely inspired by geological facts, geofacts like fossils, but you can often kind of infer there's a good chance that something like that could have happened. It's hard to know for sure.
Luckily, Mayer does go into this, though. She does explore the idea that, you know, the question, could actual winged fossil remains have influenced Mesoamerican traditions? And of course there would be no room for oral traditions of encountering these creatures here. They would have been long extinct before the first humans were around in this area. But of course, that hasn't stopped some cryptozoologists, she points out, from claiming, you know, otherwise. However, she does argue.
Oh, no. That's that, well, no, I was just thinking about the crypto, when cryptozoologists get involved.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I don't want to, not all, quote, cryptozoologists are of the same caliber.
Right. But. There's crypto, and this is something I feel like we should explore. There are certain scientific professionals, there are certain scientists who have given a lot of thought to stuff like, you know, the Yeti, mm-hmm. and have done so in a reasonable fashion, and put the scientific exploration first. There are, of course, more less scientifically based and more, you know, overly enthusiastic individuals out there who bear the cryptozoologist title.
Well, there are always going to be people who are excited about stories of, you know, any kind of interesting, unusual being of any kind, mm-hmm. because it somehow feeds into their fantastical worldview. I mean, I remember reading stories about how these native traditions of extinct races of giants in ancient Mesoamerica and in South America fed a lot of kind of like theological speculation among European Christians. You know, they'd read these stories and think, ah, this means something about the Nephilim or
the giants
whatever.
In the earth. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and you can imagine that too if you were like the spear point of a bloody you know, religious conquest of a new world, mm-hmm. and then you were learning about their traditions of giants and their belief in it. It almost is it reminds me of you know, some of the ideas we've explored with witchcraft persecution.
Yeah,
the idea that some, on some level, part of the reason for it was because if you by sort of drawing these stories out of the victims of witchcraft persecution, you were creating proof for a supernatural realm, uh-huh. that backed up your own failing religious ideas. But that's kind of a whole discussion unto itself. But at any rate, Mayer does, and you know, she doesn't explore cryptozoological ideas in this, but she does argue that the Thunderbird beliefs of North American native peoples were likely inspired by such fossils. And she asked paleontologist James Clark, who had worked with the northeastern Mexican pterosaur fossils before, if these remains would have been likely to elicit strong responses from ancient peoples. And he thought probably not. And his reasoning was that, okay, it's one thing to see a fully assembled pterosaur at your local science museum,
yeah.
or in a, you know, in a book, and certainly if it's illustrated as a living creature. But when you look at the actual fossil remains, and again, this is someone who'd worked with the actual pterosaur fossil remains from northeastern Mexico, he says you end up looking at this just jumble of bones.
That's a really good point. When you see the impressions of pterosaur fossils in situ as they're found, they're often, you know, in, say, the former flat bed of a body of water, and the indentations are just a tangled mess.
Right.
And I think a lot of this has to do with, in fact, often bird bones are the same way when they get fossilized. I think it has to do with sort of lightweight structure of the bones, the way they just kind of get all collapsed together, that they don't seem to be as often articulated and in full body posture as you might get with a larger animal with more solid bones.
Yeah, I mean, we're easily spoiled sometimes by the really nice fossil remains, mm-hmm. That we see with certain finds and certain species, where we see just a complete or near complete vision of what the creature looked like and how the bones were arranged. Mm-hmm. But that is not all fossils.
Yeah,
the whole discipline of paleontology entails a lot of reassembly of guesswork, mm-hmm. and generally and often, you know, times some of these even pterosaurs, we're dealing with creatures where we have, you know, far short of a complete fossil. Sometimes even just a single bone. And you're just having to base everything off of that, extrapolate based on other fossil remains.
Yeah, and I think it's true of pterosaurs especially, like even more so than dinosaurs generally, mm-hmm. that you have that fossils as they're found are very often unimpressive until you start extrapolating what this living creature would have looked like.
However, Mayer writes that she thinks the giant pterosaur remains in southern Mexico might have been harder to miss and might have led to some of these tales of giant winged creatures. And this would have included Aztlan, the Aztec homeland.
Hmm. Now, what about the – so we're not saying, though, that we think pterosaurs would have inspired the belief in Quetzalcoatl just because these are very differently formed creatures, right? Mm-hmm. We must be talking about some kind of other being.
Well, yeah, and luckily there are other flying creatures in Mesoamerican traditions. For instance, the Yaqui people of Sonora believed in a great bird that lived on Skeleton Mountain, or Otam Quai. And the belief was that it preyed on humans. And then when a child hero killed it, its feathers turned into all the birds that live today. But the likely suspect in these myths, Mayer says, are reports of living California condors and the fossils of older condor species. So, you know, namely the giant raptors of the Ice Age.
So these would have been more likely, if inspired by the bones of a creature or a living creature, would have been a real bird of prey rather than a pterosaur fossil.
Right. And hopefully that makes more sense. Like just, yeah. You're dealing with something, again, where there is the actual potential for an oral tradition to carry some word about it. And then you also have, on top of the fossilized condors, you have actual condors still in the world today that can be glimpsed and would have been glimpsed by some of these people we're discussing here.
So if we're talking about direct fossil inspirations that could have possibly had something to do with Quetzalcoatl himself, what we're probably talking about is the alleged reports of the handprints and the butt prints, right?
Right, which certainly feels more like basically discovering fossil evidence of the thing that you already believe in, and maybe serving as a way to, you know, physically connect with your religion and with this deity. But not the thing that inspires it outright. I think that's the idea we come back to time and time again anytime we discuss geomythology. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes it's a fun exercise to look at, like, could this fossil remain have entirely inspired this entity? Mm-hmm. But in most cases it feels like there's a number of factors, and fossils are maybe just one of those factors.
Yeah, and it's hard to know for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those things where you're almost never going to have a case where it's clear that it was inspired by a fossil legend, though you might have a few.
Yeah. You know, interesting, I was thinking about – actually, I was
– Well, actually, you know, I'd say one of the best cases of the pretty clear inspirations mm-hmm. are the ones where they bring out the bones, where people wherever they are on Earth just have bones on hand that they keep as relics and say, these are the bones
creatures. The mammoths.
Yeah.
Like this – the mammoth example that we discussed here is I think, a wonderful example of actual geomythology.
Yeah.
Like because – that's what they said. They wasn't a situation where we're just later saying maybe they could have been inspired by these bones. Well, no, they brought the bones out.
Yeah.
The bones were part of their interpretation.
Now, it is also possible that the myths actually predated the bones. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't rule that out.
That's
but
true.
It seems like it's a very good candidate that since they have the bones and they have this belief that these are linked. There's a causation link here.
I can't help but wonder how Godzilla fits into all of this, because think about it. Like Godzilla is ultimately, you know, certainly a fictional creature of mm-hmm. the modern era, but in some cases, when you consider like the secular world of popular culture, he's kind of a god. I mean, we said Godzilla in the English name for Gojira. So
more kind of an old school god, right?
Yeah.
Maybe one of those gods like Poseidon that most of the time isn't nice.
Yeah, that rises up out of the sea to destroy us. But also there's a fossil connection because mm-hmm. Godzilla in his form is basically based on the older interpretation of Tyrannosaurus Rex fossils. You know, we know today that Tyrannosaurus Rex likely, walked with its tail out in a vertical position, you know, in a balanced position, you know, the version that we see in Jurassic Park.
Uh-huh.
But the older interpretation was that it kind of stood more upright with its tail on the ground like Godzilla does.
Right.
So there's maybe a dash of geomythology in Godzilla as well. I feel like we might need to come back and do an episode on Godzilla again because there was recently a paper that came out that looked at Godzilla's increase in size, how every film version that comes out makes Godzilla bigger, and comparing that to certain cultural changes, namely like how much money a given culture invests into its military. So that might be fun to discuss. Anytime we can discuss Godzilla on the show, it's always a win.
The saddest thing is that they wouldn't make a direct sequel to Shin Godzilla, even after they set one up.
Is it out of the question?
Well, I mean, I could be misunderstanding here. I think something happened where they couldn't make a sequel to Shin Godzilla because they were making this American movie that just came out, mm-hmm. King of the Monsters, which I haven't seen, but I've heard isn't very good. And I just want another, more in the spirit of Shin Godzilla, please. I mean, that's like the best modern Godzilla movie.
Yeah, I mean, I love probably all Godzilla movies. If you show me a Godzilla movie, I'm probably going to watch it and enjoy it. But Shin Godzilla was a real treat, a Godzilla movie that made you think.
I think I tend to like the Japanese ones better than the recent American ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree.
Shin Godzilla has the best bureaucratic meetings.
It does. I'm always describing it to my wife and saying, "Oh, you should see it. It's like a Godzilla movie, but it's full of meetings and politicians talking to each other." And she's like, "Oh, that sounds awful." And I'm like, "No, it's really good. It's just so you can't turn your head away from it." All right. Well, there you have it. A follow up to a couple of past episodes, like two prequels in one. And hey, maybe a glance at the future. Let us know, do you want to hear a whole nother episode on Godzilla? Do you want to hear more episodes on geomythology? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Your input is important to us, whether it's correcting us on something we get wrong or just, helping us to grow as we, that's part of the whole purpose of the show is that we feel like through exploring these topics, we're growing, and hopefully, listeners are growing as well and discovering new facts about the world, new avenues to explore in their own time. So let us know. There are a number of ways to reach out to us. You can find us online at stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find all the episodes, links out to some social media accounts, a t-shirt store. And as always, if you want to support the show, one of the best things you can do is to rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so. Make sure you have subscribed. And make sure you've subscribed to Invention, our show about techno history. It's a tremendous amount of fun. Each episode, a different invention, a discussion of what came before, how this invention changed things, and what came after it.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was good!
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh?
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.